As I was discussing with Laura yesterday, this week the Parliament is debating legislation that will give the Minister for Home Affairs, the beloved Mr. Dutton, the right to bar people suspected of being foreign fighters from returning to Australia for a couple of years, and the legislation will apply to both women and men who've been fighting for ISIS. Lyndia Khalil has been writing and researching the role of women in ISIS for some years. She's a research fellow in the West Asia program at the Lowy Institute, and I welcome her to Late Night Live. Lydia, how many Australian women went to join ISIS?
Well, first of all, thanks, Philip, for having me on your show. It's an interesting topic to be chatting to you about. But in terms of your question, there, according to the open sources, there are roughly about 40 women remaining that we know of that are held in Kurdish-controlled camps that went to Islamic State-controlled territory. In terms of how much overall went over there, unfortunately, we don't have a direct breakdown of them. But again, I think the number would be around 40 to 50, according to what's available in the open sources.
Now, let the record show that some women are claiming that they're only involved in domestic duties, and now they want to return from the refugee camps in Syria. And the question, the political and the moral question, is should they be treated differently to the men? Now, the involvement of women was critical from the go-get, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. And the interesting thing is that precisely in these domestic roles that these women are saying that they, quote unquote, only performed while they were over there, in fact, according to the Islamic State itself, constituted a very significant and essential support for the organization. The Islamic State recognized the role of women to their endeavor very, very early on. They advertised it. They used it in their propaganda. They had a lot of female propagandists and ideologues who wrote for their publications talking about this domestic role of women as being essential to the growth of the Islamic State, both in Iraq and Syria and around the world. They viewed women as essential to the establishment of their caliphate. It wasn't enough just to have men come on as these and have it be this male adventure. You know, when we think of a terrorist, we think of a bearded guy in fatigues with a Kalashnikov. But in fact, for the Islamic State, it was much more than that. It was about bringing up an entirely new utopian society through jihadism. And women were essential to that because they were the bearers of the next generation, and they established the homes. They supported their husbands and sons. And for the Islamic State, that was an essential role.
Lydia, in thinking about your appearance on the program tonight, I've been reading a lot of stuff, documentation from the caliphate, and it was incredibly comprehensive. It wasn't simply waging war. There were rules and regulations on just about every imaginable topic, down to such odd things as how to play billiards appropriately. It was a vision splendid in their terms, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, they were trying to govern. They weren't just there to commit terrorist attacks or to have an insurgency. Their vision was to create a state, to create a governance project, and that's what they did for a very short time. Now they've kind of returned back to their insurgent global terrorist origins, but during the time of the caliphate, they had an established bureaucracy and an infrastructure in order to establish rules and regulations for what they deem to be the true Islamic way of living.
Talking to Lydia Khalil, and we're establishing that it wasn't just a boy's own adventure, but a genuine attempt at creating a new society. So what was it about the caliphate that was so appealing to women?
Well, I think that the caliphate and the message of the Islamic State ideology appealed to women in the same way that it appealed to men. You know, they had their political grievances that the state spoke to, the desire to live in what they believed to be a quote-unquote pure Islamic society, to flee from whatever problems or grievances they had back home and move on to something utopian. So the motivations for women and men were quite similar. In the media and in the public discourse, we often talk about the women who joined up with the Islamic State as jihadi brides. And I really dislike that term because it makes it seem as that they were just there, you know, to shack up with some male jihadis for a sense of adventure, or that they were duped into doing this by male recruiters. And it takes away the sense of agency that these women exhibited in actually joining this organization. So when we think about their motivations to join, I think it's very dismissive to term them as just mere jihadi broads, or say they were just doing domestic roles, or they were tricked into going. In fact, many of these women were extremely committed and had the same type of ideological and political motivations to join this group as their male counterparts.
So although ISIS placed many restrictions on women, they also empowered them by raising the importance of their role as wives and mothers, and how important they were to the mission. And in doing so, they'd also empower them to defy their parents, even their husbands, and travel alone if necessary.
That's right. That's an argument that I make in the paper that for the Lowy Institute on this topic. And we have to remember here, empowerment is within a very rigid confine of jihadism and the Islamic State, but in power nevertheless. What's interesting to note, too, that many of the families that traveled to the caliphate were, in fact, goaded into doing so by the women of those families. A lot of the wives were behind telling their husbands, "We want to go." And many women, and many instances of young women, out of their own initiative, traveled to the caliphate because they found it appealing. And they set out an ideology within and an argument that allowed women to do so. So they said, you know, we are waging a jihad, we are creating a caliphate. If you are a true Muslim, it's incumbent upon you to come. If you don't, you're committing a sin. And because it's incumbent upon you, you can defy anyone who would traditionally have authority over you, whether it would be family, husband, you know, the society and the laws that you live under, if it's a secular one. And you can defy all of that in order to come join us in the caliphate.
Lydia, I'm fascinated by your description of the role of women evolving over the lifetime of the caliphate, at least to this point. We'll get onto the possibility of it re-emerging again down later in our chat. But what about the use of suicide bombers? There is precedent for women being used in this way, but I understand from you that ISIS wasn't too thrilled at that idea.
Yeah, well, you're correct to say that there is precedent for female suicide bombers. In fact, the first female suicide bomber, in fact, was not part of a jihadist or Islamic group. It was a Palestinian nationalist group in the Middle East. And various other jihadist groups had used female suicide bombers. In the beginning, the Islamic State, when they were in their kind of governance building, state building phase, emphasized the role of wife and mother. For women, they discouraged women from being actively part of combat. They didn't feel that that was a role that they should play. Having said that, however, despite the fact that they emphasized the role of wife and mother and kept women cloistered and had very prescribed roles for them, they did use them for various other roles that jihadist groups traditionally did not do. So, for example, one of them was the use of female Hizbah force, or female morality police. And perhaps some of your listeners might remember the news reports of women who would go out along with some Islamic State fighters in Iraq and Syria when they held territory, basically patrolling the streets, looking for people who committed infractions against the very strict
rules. So this is the morality police, so-called.
Right. I mean, they're basically a brigade of you know, black niqab wearing Aunt Lydia's, you know, if we want to talk about a popular reference of The Handmaid's Tale. And they would go out, they had weapons training, and they essentially patrolled the streets and looked for women who either were not properly covered up or who shouldn't be where they were, and would commit punishment. They also were involved in operational things like, you know, again, helping fighters with checkpoints or doing house raids where women would be present. So even though in the beginning the group did emphasize that domestic role, from very early on, women in the organization had these outside roles. And as the territory declined, as the coalition put more pressure on them, and they became more of an insurgency mode, women had more and more of a combat role, a permissible combat role in the Islamic State, to the point where the Islamic State said it's in fact an obligation for women to come out and fight.
But of course they were also involved in recruitment, like Australian Zahra Duman and Shadi Jabbar.
That's right. Women played a really important recruitment role. There's been a lot of emphasis, particularly on Western female recruiters and how they were active online to either directly recruit. They were in touch directly with individuals one-on-one, convincing them to come, giving them instructions on how to come to Iraq and Syria, or more generally acting as influencers or propagandists and putting general calls out on social media. But what's also not as widely known is that women within the within Syria who are Islamic State supporters actually played significant roles in recruiting the domestic Syrian and Iraqi population to join the Islamic State as well. That was a very important role that they played for the Islamic State in that theater. So they had very they've had very active roles. And according to one study that I had read in doing some of this research for this piece, women who are Islamic State supporters actually, a greater percentage of them identified their primary role as recruiter above wife or mother, which I found very interesting, and which goes to show you the power that women had as influencers and recruiters in that organization.
We've talked about the evolving role, the changing role, and when times got tough in the caliphate, women were encouraged to take on some combat roles, but they were used to also to shame men into taking part.
Yeah, the call for women to join the battlefield was an interesting one because it was obviously a departure for a lot of jihadist groups. Many jihadist groups tolerated, I would say, women in combat, either as suicide bombers or in some sort of operations, but they never actively encouraged it. And they certainly didn't put out propaganda like the Islamic State did in their video that showed women, covered up with Kalashnikovs on the front lines. Now, it's questionable whether they were in fact women or not, or whether this was just a propaganda theater. But at any rate, that's how they showed them. But we didn't see a huge number of women, actually, at the end days of the caliphate on the front line. And that's an interesting question as to why that is. And it seemed like the answer came a couple of months later when a lot of these women and children actually ended up in Kurdish-controlled camps after the fall of the caliphate and their territorial control collapsed. And it seemed that they were using women, they viewed them as much more essential to the future of their organization and far less expendable to men. So they didn't want to expend these women dying out in the battlefields as they did men. Rather, the women were essential to the future because they were the bearers of the next generation and they could, again, recruit other people and they could promote the ideology.
Well, there are 73,000, mostly women and children, currently in camps in Syria. And as you point out, they seem to be the future of ISIS. And of them, 10,000 are foreigners.
Yeah, it's quite a big number, much more than we had anticipated, and I think governments around the world anticipated. A couple of years ago, when we had an inclination that the Islamic State territory was about to collapse, I'd worked on another piece on the trajectory of foreign fighters. Where would they go? And I have to admit, at the time, we were thinking mostly of men, of combatants, and saying, well, they could either come back to their home countries, die on the battlefield, and we mapped out a variety of other trajectories for foreign fighters or the cohort that we would have to deal with after the collapse of the Islamic State. Nobody had thought that it would be such a huge number of women and children. And so in some ways, we've been caught a bit unawares or unprepared, governments around the world, and exactly how to identify their role, identify their threat, and what to do with them.
Well, you've made the point that some have been active fighters may have been instructed to lay down their weapons and bide their time until the caliphate can rise again.
Yeah, that's something that many of the women interviewed in the camps have stated publicly with journalists who've gone to interview them. They say that this is what we've been instructed to do. The Islamic State will rise again. We haven't given up the cause. And they certainly haven't. While some women may have regretted their choice to go, a great deal of them are actually still very much holding on to the ideology, are in fact enforcing the same rules that the Islamic State did at those camps, have been threatening and beating up women who are not following those rules. And just the other week, there was a video going around the internet where the women in these camps actually hoisted up the Islamic State flag in one of the Kurdish camps. So certainly they are still holding on to the ideology and their belief in the organization.
Are women therefore benefiting from the perception of them as victims with limited agency?
I think that has been the idea that's gone around, but as this has developed, I think a lot of governments are starting to understand and realize that women can no longer benefit from positive security bias that we often afford women, particularly mothers, and that their role in the Islamic State is actually quite much more extensive than we thought it did, and they need to be treated much the same way that male supporters of the Islamic State need to be.
If you were given ministerial responsibility for the issue in Australia, what would you advise?
Well, I'd advise that in looking at threat assessments in terms of women and children who are returning, that we need to pay close attention to this idea that many of them actually had no active role and were just performing domestic duties. And I would argue that performing these domestic duties actually constitute some form of terrorist support. It's a difficult argument to be made. It's a difficult one to be proven in courts, but some courts around the world are doing that. I'm thinking of a case in Germany where they're trying to say that domestic support actually constitute support of a terrorist organization. And I would also say that leaving a lot of these women to fester in the Kurdish-controlled camps is a bad idea. I know there's a great resistance to repatriating these individuals into Australia because of whatever potential risks, but I would argue that the risk that they pose simply doesn't go away, but in fact could increase the longer they are in these camps and are not repatriated to Australia.
Lydia, thank you for your time. Lydia Khalil, Research Fellow, West Asia Program at the Lowy Institute, LNL on RN.